I think we're in business.
Excellent. Hello, I'm Simon Mercier. This is Crave. It's the podcast dedicated to film, music, and basically just about anything that's been entertaining me and Steve McCabe lately.
And this week, we have an embarrassment of riches. We've got a bountiful offering this week. We've got, well, we'll start with two rock stars who are, despite, as they both pointed out, their advancing years, they're still doing the business. Sheryl Crow and Melissa Etheridge played in Auckland the other night.
Yeah, they weren't shy about talking about their age, were they?
No.
A slightly younger performer, I think. Steve has been to see soul singer. Is that a fair way to describe him?
We'll take it, yeah.
Yeah, soul singer Rag and Bone Man in Auckland. And we've had a guest reviewer for Crave, Sue Wells, catching the same act in Christchurch. So the two of them will compare their notes.
I went alone to see the Guernsey Literary and Potato Peel Society. A new film by Mike Newell that's just coming out soon.
Okay, I'm not sure whether I should have gone to that or not, but what I did do is I will speak softly to you while chatting about a horror thriller called A Quiet Place.
Significantly less quietly, I think you and I are going to have a quick kick around of Early Man, and we'll try and figure out, is its timing directly before the school holidays entirely appropriate?
I think we might have an interesting discussion about that. And we have more. Yes, more. I'm going to first of all briefly mention a world-famous magician I met. But also this week, something a little bit different, we have some theatre, do we not, Steve?
We do indeed. Penny Ashton is currently touring New Zealand with her new one-woman show, Olive Copperbottom. And so I had a quick chat with Penny about how that's going.
Excellent.
So let's get into this, shall we? Now, Simon, you and I, we were at the Trusts Arena up in West Auckland a couple of nights ago. It was one of these double billings that's been kind of the thing lately, hasn't it? We had Stevie Nicks and Chrissy Hynde here last year.
Yes,
we had,
that's right.
Debbie Harry and Blondie were playing with Cyndi Lauper last year. And so this time around, it was Sheryl Crow and Melissa Etheridge. Now, they've been around for, well, longer than we have.
Well, in my case, not so about the same number of years as me. They were, and I have to say, I don't think we have to spend too much time talking about these two, because I actually thought they were really, really good. The key thing is they both played as if they still give a damn. I think that's the most important thing about acts like this. That, you know, these guys, women are midish to mid late-ish 50s, been singing their big songs probably for many, many years. And I thought, Steve, there was an energy and a vitality to the shows. Great bands they both had. Both were really good musicians and showed that, as well as being good singers and songwriters. And I thought they just took the audience with them and played in the moment and put on a great show. And Of the two, I expected to like Sheryl Crow more, but I ended up liking Sheryl Crow, but thinking Melissa Etheridge was just fantastic.
I have to agree with you. We'll just get Sheryl out of the way very, very quickly, because, I mean, she was, appropriately enough, the first one on. I mean, in some ways, not entirely fair to say, but she was a support act. And let's face it, I mean, her music's always been a bit lightweight, a bit frothy, a bit fun. There's a little bit of substance to it, but not enormously so. And I mean, she played, as you say, basically a greatest hit set. I think there was one obligatory new song, but basically, yes. It was all the hits. There was All They Want to Do. There was My Favorite Mistake. Every Day is a Winding Road. There was all the songs you'd expect her to play, and she played them by the numbers. You could almost have been listening to the record, quite frankly, in some places.
Possibly so. I've quite liked her for a long time. I agree she's probably on the lighter end of the spectrum, Steve. But I've thought her hits have been quite catchy. One thing I was interested in seeing that made it a little more interesting for me was to see the range of instruments Sheryl Crow played, because she didn't. I expected her to play acoustic guitar and I guess electric guitar, but she also played bass guitar on several songs.
Decently, and
harmonica and keyboards. So I thought, yeah, okay, you got it, Sheryl. You wrote the stuff and you're playing all the instruments you need to play to perform it. So nothing perhaps surprising about her set, but professional, and I thought there was enough energy there to make me think, okay, yep, You still got it.
Well, she's still enjoying it. And I think that was fairly clear to see.
Yeah.
I was curious when her band started playing the intro to Heartbreaker by the Rolling Stones, only for it to segue into There Goes the Neighbourhood. But it was a fun show. Her voice occasionally gets a little bit sort of shrill, little girly for my tastes.
I think that's, yeah, I would say that, oh gosh, well, if we're going to be really honest, I have to say I agree with you on that. On some of the choruses, it sounds like, criticizing her voice, but
yeah,
it sounds like there's sort of a reaching thing happening there. And
very, very slightly.
Yeah, and other times I think with some of the other areas she sings, she has gets a bit lower, a bit more soulful, and I found that a much more enjoyable aspect of her singing. But Melissa Etheridge, Steve.
Oh, now we're talking.
That was full on, gutsy, powerful, take no quarters rock is what that was.
Well, she came out on stage the first thing we saw of her was under faint red lights. We suddenly saw what looked like a blonde haired head behind the drum kit.
Yes.
Next thing you know, she hops out from behind the drum riser, straps on a big silvery Gretsch semi-acoustic guitar, and starts shredding for all her life's worth.
She does, and I think for all her life's worth is a key phrase there, because I mean, I guess these songs, and in many ways, this set was also a greatest hit set, and she's probably played songs like "Bring Me Some Water" and "Come On Over," you know, a million times.
Oh, yes.
But I've got to say, the interpretations of the songs was fantastic. This, she seemed to be trying to breathe a little more life into the interpretation of the song, was totally committed to each song, and was pretty much the only guitarist. It was a bit of a surprise to me. I didn't realize how good she was on guitar. That's showing my ignorance there, but she's a really good guitar player, and of course she's got that fantastic rock voice, and I she really won me over big time, and I thought Melissa, you've still got it.
Hasn't she just? I asked her about playing the same songs over and over again when I spoke to her a couple of weeks ago.
Yes, of course. Yes.
We interviewed her for an earlier episode of Crave. Yes. And she did comment that once she starts chopping out the chords for Bring Me Some Water, it's a song she's been playing since the late 80s. It's 30 years she's been playing that song every single night on stage now. And she says the response it gets from the audience is what gets her going. And so so she started playing, and it lasted for, I think, 9 minutes. and she takes that song in places you'd never imagine listening to the record it would ever go. It becomes the most glorious workout on an acoustic guitar. She is astonishing.
Yeah, yeah. And that was a song, wasn't it, Steve, where she basically was just strumming.
Yes.
I mean, she chopped and changed her rhythm, but she wasn't playing lead breaks. She just took us through a fantastic smorgasbord of what you can do just playing rhythm. And it was really, really good. Both sets were not long sets, but I think that was good. I think that, you know, you got two, just over an hour each, I think.
Yeah, about that.
Hour 10, roughly. Really good. It's certainly with Melissa, you felt like you could have listened to more, and that's always a good way to end a concert, isn't it? Because it might bring you back another time. So I would, absolutely recommend both, and particularly Melissa Etheridge.
Oh, I'd see the pair of them again tomorrow if I could. They were superb.
Yeah.
I was very, very impressed.
Now, Steve, let's move on, because there was one act I talked about last episode. I said, I'm really looking forward to seeing this guy. And as it turned out, I couldn't get there. I was disappointed. But you saw him. We're talking about Rag and Bone Man. You got to his Auckland show, and we had our Crave spies out in Christchurch too, did we not? So pick up the story, if you would.
Well, we managed to arrange review tickets. Usually these acts start their tours up here in Auckland, and so that's where the coverage starts. But for some reason, Rag and Bone Man went down south first, and he opened up the Horncastle Arena in Christchurch. And so, because obviously, you know, we want to be ahead of the game when it comes to our coverage, we scored review tickets for Sue Wells, who went to the show for us in Christchurch. I was there a couple of nights later in Auckland, and so Sue and I caught up a few days later to have a bit of a chat about the show. So carrying on our coverage of Rag and Bone Man, we've got photos on our website, and we've got Sue Wells from Christchurch has her written review posted, but Sue's agreed to come on the show today to have a quick chat with us, and so she and I are going to compare notes on the show. So Sue, you saw Rag and Bone Man on his first night in New Zealand, down in Christchurch.
Tuesday night, date night, hot off the heels of Ed Sheeran, we drove back up from Dunedin, had a quick rest, and then it was Rag and Bone Man, and he rattled.
He rattled.
Let's try that again, because I've leapt straight into the good stuff.
No, that's fine. We have good audio editing software, so let's go. So you saw him on his first night in New Zealand at Christchurch. What did you think of the show?
I thought he was 9 out of 10 vocally.
Yep.
6 out of 10 performance.
Oh, dear.
4 out of 10 for venue.
Yep.
Price point, he was... his tickets were too cheap.
Mm-hmm.
$52. You could have got 70 for it. I just think he was... I don't think he's ripe yet.
Okay.
He's a beautiful, beautiful, beautiful voice. Amazing lyrics. He's got a big, big band behind him. And I felt like he was coated in the band the whole time. And I couldn't get enough airspace around him to just really appreciate what he was doing. It was like a beautiful Thai salad that was drenched in hollandaise. You know, I needed to hear him on his own.
Yeah.
And I felt that he was lacking a certain amount of confidence somehow, that he was almost dependent on the band.
Oh, okay.
Mm.
See, I the way I read that aspect of it, to me, I got the impression that he almost couldn't quite believe his look.
I agree. Completely agree.
He seemed genuinely... So, I mean, on the one hand, it was delighted enthusiasm. He was almost like a giddy little kid going, "Well, I can't believe I'm here." But
yeah,
I can see how you could cross that over into lack of confidence. And for a chap of his size, it's an odd, jarring little combination of appearances, really, isn't it?
Well, he's probably shy boy rather than thug, tattoos, piercings, and all.
Notwithstanding, yes.
Yeah, I certainly saw a bit of possum in the headlights.
Yes.
And I agree. I thought he just couldn't believe how good he was. And he couldn't believe people were there to see him. But I felt like he was a guy that I would have been, that's, you know, probably done all the working men's clubs and that sort of thing. And someone's realized how good he is.
Yeah.
But they haven't wrapped any more support around him than that. He hasn't had any more production or help than that. And you feel like you're watching I felt like I was watching a working men's club show on the big stage, and having come right off the back of Ed Sheeran that I'd seen two nights before, you know, there's a one-man band that can still fill a stadium, make it a show, and the crowd just goes insane. And this was literally just some folks standing up playing music and singing, and it's like, it's a bit high school.
It was a somewhat flat production, really, to be fair, wasn't it? You've got half a dozen backing musicians around the back of the stage, and then you've got your man Rory sort of stomping around, looking a little bit embarrassed, and then opening his mouth and unleashing a ferociously wonderful voice.
Yeah. There was, I mean, I wouldn't call it a flat production. I'd say there was no production.
Oh, you're being harsher than I am.
Oh, I'm not being harsh. I don't think I'm being harsh at all. I think that's a fair fact. You literally did just have the band standing around, and I didn't even think the band was that well balanced acoustically. Particularly the horns, they were really big.
Yeah.
And he was competing with them a lot of the time, which to me just meant that the real star of the show was getting a bit dwarfed. It's hard to dwarf him.
It is, isn't it? Yes. But even that voice is hard to dwarf. Well, one thing that struck me as I was watching, he was playing an awful lot of his newer stuff, which is the big hits from his album Human, which obviously is what got him where he is right now. But halfway through, he played a song called Hard Comes the Rain, which is from his older material. And suddenly, it was basically him and a guitar.
Yeah, and that's when I just went, oh my God, now I know why I'm here.
Yes.
And I think I'm falling in love. Yep, sorry, darling, you've got competition. I mean, oh God, that voice. I wanted more of that.
And all there was just this spiky, angular little guitar line behind it. It didn't need the huge, great big wall of sound that they were trying to give him.
Yeah, I actually found that the great big wall of sound was exactly what he didn't need. It was like wrapping him up in a duvet.
Yes.
You know, I just wanted to see him roar.
Mm.
Because what he's got is so special. You know, he really is. He's like Adele. He's got that one-of-a-kind voice, a whole lot of it, great lyrics. And a bit like her, I think, probably doesn't have a lot of confidence or self-esteem, doesn't really like stage performances, if that was an example of that.
Yeah.
I mean, you think with The Voice, you get Meatloaf from The Voice, you get Joe Cocker, you get the really big performance acts, but he's not that on stage at all.
No, he's not, is he? No, he's like almost like a little boy, like a slightly lost little boy.
Yeah, unless he can get some really good production behind him and grow in that space, I think he is going to be relegated to a studio act, which in this modern world probably is not necessarily a bad thing.
No, there's plenty of people making a living from that.
Mm. I mean, I saw Lorde when she performed Melodrama.
Right.
You know, at the Theatre Royal in Christchurch, Isaac Theatre Royal, 1,800 seats, Lorde, her little band, and the production values, if I compare what Lorde had to what he had, probably not that different.
Yeah.
But she still had a production.
Yes.
She had production quality to her. She danced, she moved, she captivated the crowd, and she spoke and she engaged. And... oh, she cried. We cried. We all cried together.
Yeah.
Vocally, I think I put her and Rag and Bone Man in the same camp.
Right.
Production-wise, he's not got a shoo-in.
Well, I mean, I think in some ways it's unfair to compare him to actors as established as those. As one thing that comes to mind as we're talking about this, I'd suggest that maybe sticking him straight in the arenas, because he's had this one phenomenal hit in Human. I mean, it's a lovely song, and he's very impressive. But putting him straight in the big arenas probably isn't doing him any favours, because he's...
Completely agree.
He's not learned his stagecraft yet.
But he's 31, isn't he? I mean, he's not a child.
He's been around for a while, and he was talking about that between songs, and that's kind of when his stage presence comes alive, is when he does start talking to the audience. You suddenly realise that, you know, he does have a bit of a personality too that doesn't always come through in the rest of the presence of the performance. But he was talking about songs from way back, and you realise he's got an extensive back catalogue that no one knows about. And it's everything that we're seeing, this huge, enormous publicity machine, is behind one song.
I mean, he's got the look. He's certainly got a look that is very marketable, and it's very modern. And
oh, yes.
You know, it's there. I would have thought by now, at 31, having done the time, you're either a natural born performer or you've been crafted into one. Now, I might be being really unkind and really harsh. I think I would love to see what would happen if he did get the benefit of someone with really good production expertise.
Right. That would be an interesting development, wouldn't it?
I'd love to see that, because I think if he doesn't develop production wise, I'm with you at One Hit Wonder, and I would hate that to be the case, because that man's voice, I'd spread it on toast and eat it all day long.
It's a thing of great power and joy, isn't it?
Oh, it made me cry. Cry actual real tears.
Well, I'll tell you what, you wouldn't have been alone at the Auckland show. I was enjoying it in a somewhat disengaged and disinterested way, but I was looking around the arena, looking at people watching it with me, and the guy just over my right shoulder, I think he was having a religious experience. He looked like he was in a trance or a rapture or something at one point.
Yeah. Oh, I quite believe that. I mean, other half and I both came away going, oh, my God, we've just seen something tonight that in years to come, we're going to tell our grandkids we were there when he charged $50 for a ticket and there was nobody there.
Right. So you think this is one for the history books?
It's either going to be one for the history books, or it's not, but it's not going to be anywhere in between.
Right, right. So, but you're almost willing to put it up there with the Beatles at the Cavern Club?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think that the guy's a freak. His voice is, oh, God, hairs on the back of my neck standing up just thinking about it. If I had the chance to go and see him tonight, would I? Yes. Would I pay $200? Yes.
Wow, he made an impression then, didn't he?
I love his voice. Just love him. If I could get the band away from him for half an hour, I'd put him up to 400. I mean, he is that good, and I would just love to see him just sing.
Yes. Well, that's a pretty rousing and unqualified endorsement, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. It was great. It really was a game-changing night. So let's hope many more artists start their tours in Christchurch.
Fantastic. Well, Sue Wells, thank you very, very much indeed for reviewing that for Crave, and we will definitely keep you in mind for future shows.
Okay, Steve, that's really interesting. I'm kind of getting from that it's perhaps a little bit of a work in progress still, but a guy who you You'd see him again, maybe see how he's progressed in a year or two.
Well, it's like Sue and I were talking about just now. He's going to be either the biggest thing in the world or a one-hit wonder. He's going to go one of two ways. Yeah. Definitely a work in progress, but definitely one with enormous potential.
Yeah, cool. All right, then, great. Hey, let's get on to some cinema now. I want to start by telling you about a film I just saw called A Quiet Place.
Oh, yeah. Now, this is getting great reviews.
It is, yeah. And it's, I mean, if you look at the trailer and the poster, it looks pretty much like a horror movie. But I would say more accurately, Steve, it's a horror-thriller-alien-family drama.
That's very specific.
I'm not sure how busy a genre that is.
I think it's more of a niche than a genre, to be fair, isn't it, really?
Yeah, but if you are looking for a film...
Fine line between the two, to be fair.
Yeah. If you are looking for a film which ticks all those boxes, this actually is a very good one. I've got to say, I think it did a very good job because it takes a very basic idea, not an innovative idea, but the monsters or the aliens in this film, Steve, have invaded the planet. They are blind, they attack anything they hear.
Ooh.
So the film is about one family in a rural farm setting who have found out a way to survive without making any noise. And that is two-thirds, three-quarters of the film, maybe even more, is with the family as they go about living their life this way, dealing with threats as they arise without making a noise. And what works really well in this film is that the filmmakers have obviously spent a lot of time thinking about how you would do that. So you have a whole many scenes where you see them negotiating their life without making noises. For example, how do you walk down the path without crunching on leaves? How do you communicate generally? They obviously use sign language. How do you configure your house to make the least amount of noise? How do you serve your food quietly? Just all these little detail which really make the film very involving for the audience, I think, bring you into it because they makes you think, hey, how would I get on if I had to do this?
Yeah.
Obviously, this is a horror thriller, so they are brought into stark company of this alien or aliens, and it's how they deal with that threat, which is what drives the film along. There are some very good actors in this film. It's got Emily Blunt in it. Oh, I have to say I've got a bit of a liking for Emily Blunt's work. And her real-life husband, John Krasinski, is her husband in the film, and he also directed it.
Yes, his first, yeah. I believe, his first yeah. major.
Yeah, and a very good job too, I thought. And then, so they're the central characters, the husband and wife. And then they've got three children, and one's very young, and then the eldest is played by Millicent Simmons, the other one by Noah Jupe. They are also very good. And so I think the key thing is here, Steve, there is a soundtrack which does appear from time to time, but there's a lot of quiet in this film.
Well, there would be, wouldn't there? Yes.
There would be, yes. So... I could actually hear around me, I got the sense, and I picked up a couple of comments from people around me afterwards, that they didn't like that, the quiet. Maybe they found it a little bit uncomfortable.
Isn't that rather the point?
Yes, yeah, I think it is. But I thought it did a very good job of drawing you in. There was some genuine tension because of that quietness. I would recommend it if you're into, so that's thrillers, horror movies with a bit of a sci-fi edge. It's a really, really good example of. But I would mention is when you do finally get to see the alien, and they thankfully spend a lot of time where you hardly ever see it at all, and to build up the tension, I don't know, it looks to me not that dissimilar from a lot of other aliens you've seen in movies, and maybe it's difficult to come up with an alien that looks different. And the other final point I just had a little bit of a concern about was they just couldn't help but slip in a little bit of a touch of machismo, or... yeah, that's the best word for it, right at the end of the movie, which to me was a little bit out of kilter with the tone of the rest of it.
Well, it's kind of out of kilter with John Krasinski. I'm assuming that's who gets his macho on here. And that's not usually who he is, especially, is it?
I don't want to say too much more to spoil it, because it is a film where I'm not giving much of the plot away, because I think there's some genuine pleasure to be had in the twists and turns of the thriller. But they do go to a lot of trouble to, as realistically as possible, given the incredible premise of this thing, to give you a sense of what it would be like to be in this position. So I think that's where the film works really, really well. Good acting, good thrills and tension. And if this is your type of film, I would highly recommend it.
Oh, I'm very, very tempted to give it a look. You're not yours, obviously, is the most important one, obviously, but it's not the first compelling review I've heard of this film. And I definitely find myself thinking, I need to investigate it a little bit.
Yeah, I think because I don't think this would probably normally be your type of movie, would it, Steve?
But
I
not entirely. No,
no.
I mean, as we said, it is a very, very specific genre.
Yeah. Yeah.
But
okay.
I am inclined to investigate. I seriously am.
All right. So I have to say, there's a film you've seen which probably, on the look of it, I wouldn't necessarily want to rush out to see. But you could possibly convince me otherwise. This is this film with a very wordy title: The Guernsey Literary and Potato Peel Society.
The Guernsey Literary and Potato Peel Society. It's a fantastic name for film, isn't it?
Was it a book? I think it was a book.
It was a book originally, yes. It was. Yeah. It's a historical drama romance.
Okay.
And the problem for my money is that the balance of those three is completely off.
Oh, okay.
Well, okay. Here's something I put in my review on our website.
Yeah.
But you've got the basic setup is there's a young woman, she's a writer of some sort in early post-war London. Her name's Juliet. She's played by Lily James, and she's written a book, a copy of which has her address in it, gets into the hands of a chap named Dorsey Adams, played by, I believe, Michiel Huisman, who was one of the various Dario Naharises in Game of Thrones.
Okay.
He's a pig farmer on Guernsey. And he likes the book, and so he writes to her, and they strike up a friendship that leads to her going out to visit him on Guernsey. Shortly after the Nazi occupation of Guernsey has been lifted by the end of the Second World War. Now, if I tell you that in addition to that, she is engaged to an American army officer based in London... Can you guess where this film is headed?
Are we talking love triangle?
Of course we are.
Just a wild guess.
I mean, if you like I wrote, if you can't figure out where this is going, you're not really paying attention. And the thing is that then becomes the focus of the film. But while she's on Guernsey, and obviously because she's a writer, and she's got that sort of writer's journalistic instinct, and she wants to start digging.
Yeah.
And she starts turning up bits of a deeper backstory. And I won't go into too much detail because, you know, if you do want to go and see this film, then discover it for yourself. But there's a backstory for many of the characters that involves what could be construed as collaboration and fraternization with the enemy during the Nazi occupation of Guernsey.
Right. Okay.
And little by little, Mike Newell, the director, sort of teases these ideas of what could have been a very, very fascinating and quite scandalous. I mean, it's fictional, but you have to figure that it's got a basis in some layer of fact.
Yeah.
Fascinating story of interactions and intercourse crossing the lines during the occupation. And all I kept thinking was, tell me more about that. I want to know more about that story. That's the story I want to hear. Because, let's be honest, Lily James is a very, very, very good supporting actress.
Right.
She is not, I don't think yet at least, and maybe she will one day, she's not yet a very, very good leading actress. She is not up to the task of carrying a film like this on her own, and that's what they're asking her to do, and she's not up to the task. And as a result, she's very light and frothy and lovely and adorable, and she absolutely is. But as a result, the film, which should be about something really quite dark, is similarly light and frothy and adorable and lovely and cute.
Yeah.
And the sad thing is, if you look at the rest of the cast, you've got Penelope Wilton in this and Tom Courtney.
Okay.
They don't get out of second gear.
Okay. Well, I think I'm not rushing out to buy a ticket for this one, I have to say.
No, if you've seen the book, if you've read the book, go and see the film. You'll possibly have a lot more affection for it. But it's not meaty enough. It's not rich enough. It's just a little bit too flimsy for my taste.
All right. Okay, well, we've both traded views of films we've seen on our lonesome, Steve, but here's one that we both saw, not at the same time, but we've both seen it. It's one of those animated features, isn't it, which I guess is pitch.
I see what you did. I see what you did there, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, at adults and kids. It's called Early Man. Certainly got some very talented, top-notch voice talent in it. And it's, when I say animated, it's like that sort of Wallace and Gromit animation
it's
we're talking about.
The stop-motion claymation, yes, they call it, yeah. Yes.
Fascinating exploration of the origins of football. Why don't you kick us off on this one?
Oh, yes. It doesn't stop, does it? Well, no. Well, in many ways, I'm the right man to kick this one off, to be honest, because if you remember, yes. the opening title says it's actually set in Manchester.
No, yes.
In indeed, as it says, the late Plasticine era.
Yes.
Which is just, you know, an idea of the kind of non-stop visual gags that you get in a film like this, because it's made by Nick Park of Aardman Studios, the same fella who we have to thank for such, and I say this without any irony whatsoever, such a genius of the Wallace and Gromit films, which are priceless and timeless, and I absolutely adore them, and the man can do no wrong for me, I have to tell you.
Okay, and is that the same here for you, that he didn't do any wrong?
He did very, very little wrong. It was, it's a curious story. So you've got a bunch of cavemen.
Yes, we should talk about the story, shouldn't we?
Very, very briefly, because it is relevant. Yes. There's a bunch of cavemen, led by their chief, voiced by Timothy Spall, and then Doug, yes, who's the young thrusting hero, voiced by Eddie Redmayne.
Yes,
who live in a little valley that's suddenly invaded by Bronze Age people who are basically medieval, pretty much.
Yes, they
in
are.
Terms of their times, but they claim to be Bronze Age. They're very aware of their Bronze Ageness and their non Stone Ageness, led by Tom Hiddleston having far too much fun as their leader, Lord Nuth.
Indeed,
it's very, very silly, and so they are going to take over. So they're going to mine the valley for bronze. They're going to enslave the Stone Age, the early men, as they refer to them, yes, and take them off to their city.
Well, they're going to be cast out into the wilderness, basically, right? Yes.
They are absolutely into the Badlands, I think they call it.
Yeah.
Until Doug discovers that they're playing football in the Bronze Age city in a huge stadium. But who cares? I mean, you don't fuss about details like that in a film like this, because it's done so adorably. And so, long story, because a little bit shorter, yeah, they end up training the early men team to play football to challenge Real Bronzio, the local team.
Yes, and with helping them train is Guna, played by Maisie Williams.
Yes. Whose dream has always been to play in on the hallowed turf, but obviously being a lady, she's not allowed to. And so, you know, their strip is red shirts and white shorts, which is quite delightfully appropriate.
Someone from Manchester, that's right.
And you've got Rob Brydon voicing two English football commentators called Brian and Brian. And one of them even turns to the other and says, they're playing together well as a team. They're like early man united. And there is so many subtle football jokes. I think if you're possibly not from England and not even, I'm not a massive football fan, but I've just absorbed enough that I picked up loads of jokes. Like Lord Nuth, he's the supreme leader, the premium leader. Oh, your premiership. He gets redressed at one time. So there's masses of football gags all the way through it.
Yeah, there are. I'm going to say to you, though, it's always good to have a vibrant discussion.
Oh, you're not going to challenge me. No, you are not going to challenge me on this. It was lovely.
Well, you know what? I didn't, for some reason, I just didn't get into it as much as I wanted.
Simon.
No. See me, hear me out. One of the things that was, I at one point thought I would take my young grandson along, and I couldn't do it in the end. And I'm glad I didn't. I don't think he would have enjoyed it, because I think that a lot of the humor was quite subtle and clever, and I think would have gone way, way over a 6.5-year-old's head.
I'll allow that, yeah.
I like football, and I enjoyed the gags, and there's a lot of visual gags. There's a lot of sort of Flintstone type stuff early on, showing how the technology, they adapt the technology, like how you shave, how you cross the road.
Yes.
I won't spoil the jokes, but there's a lot of that type of humor. I sort of felt actually these sort of films, they often are, you know, on the face of it, you think they're for kids, but really they're as much for adults. I felt this was more for adults than for kids. And I just felt like it traversed territory I've kind of seen before a little bit. Maybe I'm not as much of a fan of the Wallace and Gromit type humor as you are. I thought it was very clever, but didn't sing for me quite as much. I guess I could see where the story's going. There's no surprise.
Of course,
you know,
not in the slightest.
There are some genuine laughs. Maybe this is what made a difference to me, Steve. When I saw this film, I was the only person in the cinema.
Okay, that would be weird. I saw it on a Sunday morning in Pukekohe, and there was about a dozen other people, including children who were laughing.
Oh, were they okay? Well, and were they? Would you hazard a guess at their age? Were they 10 or five or
somewhere between those two? I'd guess possibly closer to 5 than to 10.
Oh, really? Okay, well, that's interesting.
They were laughing enough. I wanted to slap them. I mean, they were being annoying. I didn't get the privilege of a private screening.
Well, the funny thing, I mean, I did laugh sometimes. I don't want to say it wasn't awful by any means, but it was strange to laugh out loud and I'm the only one there. And maybe that affected my mindset a little bit. It became just a touch predictable for me.
Okay.
But I enjoyed, there is visual and verbal humor to be enjoyed, and it's quite clever and it's tongue in cheek. But didn't take me quite to a fresh enough place. For
right.
Me to, that's the word I'm looking for, fresh. But what it did do, it did very well.
There is no joy left in your soul, is there, Simon?
Oh, God, I've been doing this too long.
I know. But, I mean, I love listening to you. You've got Johnny Vegas voicing Asbo. And he's a bizarre voice, but I could listen to him all day. You've got Richard Ayoade as another voice talent for the early men. It's just beautifully, beautifully done. I really enjoyed it.
Oh, good. Well, there you are. Well, look, I think that's fine. If you do get, I mean, it's one of those sort of films that I think a lot of people will enjoy, and you know, let's hope our listeners get a chance to see it, and maybe they'll tell us what they think about it. hey, let's move on, because we also want to talk about a topic we don't cover so much, and I'm really glad we're doing it this week, Steve, and that's theatre.
Yes.
Please pick up on this.
Well, we've got a couple of things to talk about, don't we? I'll start off with one for myself.
Yes.
Penny Ashton is a name that you'll probably remember from your radio days. That's how I got to know her originally as well.
Yeah.
And I'm trying to think, it'd be about 2 years ago now, I reviewed her last one-woman show.
I remember you talking about that and enjoying it very much.
Absolutely. It's a Jane Austen-based show. And now she's now updated her show a little bit. She's now got a new one based on the works of Charles Dickens, and it's called Olive Copperbottom.
Okay.
I know. And she's doing a 30-some date tour of the entire country. I mean, she's got as far as the Cargill. She's going everywhere.
Goodness.
And so she managed to carve a few minutes out of her genuinely busy schedule for Crave a couple of days ago, and here's what she had to say. Penny Ashton, thank you very much for talking to Crave today. Tell us where you are right now.
I am sitting in the dressing room of the Expressions, which is a wonderful art centre in Upper Hutt. So that's where I am right now. My technician is running around on stage, setting up my lights, and I am in an excessive air conditioning, though. Pretty bit chilly sitting here talking to you.
Oh, dear. Now, what on earth is taking you to Upper Hutt?
I'm doing my show Olive Copperbottom, which is a Dickensian tale of love, gin and pox. And I'm doing a big tour of New Zealand with a group called Arts on Tour, who are fabulous. They run tours all over New Zealand. They've been doing it for nearly 30 years. This guy's based out of Christchurch, and he comes up with this little menu and sends it out to prospective buyers all over the country, and they decide which shows they want to buy of the 10 tours that he does every year. I'm doing 34 dates from Whangarei down to Invercargill and many, many points in between.
34 dates. That's quite a comprehensive tour, isn't it?
Yes, it certainly is. Yeah, I'm doing and all the big centres too. Like I did Northwood last night, which I've never been to, which is tiny. But they're doing Waikaya, which I didn't even know what it was, but that's near Gore. I'm doing, you know, I did Whirianga, Coromandel, Taupo. I'm not doing Taupo, actually. I'm doing Tokoroa, New Plymouth, what is that place called? Hilarious. I can't remember the name of the places. They're so small.
and there's so many of them.
Yeah, and that's what I like about it, though. It's fabulous. Like, they're going to all these places that are tiny, you hadn't heard of before, and then, like, 100 or 50 or 60 people turn up, you know, to come and enjoy the show, who may be farmers or live in these rural sort of communities. And then I'm doing Howick in Auckland, and Upper Hutt, obviously, is a bit more urban, and Christchurch and some other places in between, and Invercargill, Whangarei, places like that, too.
Sounds brilliant. Now, I know your last show, Promise and Promiscuity, it was a one-woman show with a cast of thousands.
Nine.
Well, we round up, obviously. Tell us a little bit about Olive Copperbottom.
So Olive Copperbottom is a similar deal, but there are 15 characters. And it's a Dickensian story. The last one was a Jane Austen story, but this one has got more child murder and gruel and gin in this one, which is more tea and balls in that one. There's lots of balls jokes in that one. There's quite a few. Well, there's a character called Dick, so suffice to say there's some
jokes. Of course there is.
In this one, and it's a tale of an orphan. Spoiler alert, yeah, her mother dies in the first scene, and then she goes to whack the child home for wayward wives and strays, run by Mrs. Sourtar, who's an evil bitch. And then from there we move on to the Travelling Players, which is run by Phineas Fivestar, which is very much based on Vincent Crummles from Nicholas Nickleby. And then we go to prostitutes. We have Fanny Purchase and Mrs. Scabby Bitch, who are the prostitutes, and sort of in their world and the pub that they go to. And then there's conniving people and pure-hearted people and evil bitches and hookers with a heart of gold and all that sort of stuff along the way. And it's a musical. So there's 7 songs throughout as well.
Fantastic. Now, I confess, when I saw Promise and Promiscuity, I wasn't overly familiar with Jane Austen, but I still got a lot out of it. Do we need to be Dickensian buffs to appreciate Olive Copperbottom?
No, you really don't. And it's quite funny. I think most people sort of osmose a certain level of Dickensian, you know, world without even trying if they've seen Oliver the Musical or, you know, A Christmas Carol, or the Twist, that sort of stuff. You just sort of know it's about sort of dirty urchins and the evil buggers a lot of the time. So, no, you don't have to, because what, same with my Promise and Promiscuity one, I haven't, like, taken a story of theirs and doing it my own way. It's a brand new story in the style of Dickens. So you'll be surprised, you know, if you do know your Dickens, you'll recognise different levels, different character tropes and styles, but yet it's a new story, so you don't have to know it all. And a lot of people have been like, oh, I should have brought my husband. He would have really enjoyed it, all the dick jokes. And stuff like that. So there's lots of innuendo and songs and stuff to keep people entertained too.
So it's not a family show then?
Well, I sort of say PG-14. I've had some 12-year-olds and they had a nice time, so it's not too bad.
Fair enough. And do you ever get, like, Dickensian scholars or indeed Austen scholars coming and telling you got it all wrong?
No, they generally really, really like it. Like, you know, the first few times that happened, I was a little concerned. But they can see that there's a lot of work. Like, there's about 8 different book titles sprinkled throughout, just, you know, as a turn of phrase, like, oh, how is Our Mutual Friend? You know, which is the title of one of Dickens' books and things like that. So they recognise that.
Yes.
But this woman came to see the show last night. She went, oh, I love how the locket, you incorporate, there's a locket that's like in Oliver Twist. There's the whole... the son, there's a son's mistaken identity around a son, which is Nicholas Nickleby, and she recognised all of those, but they're in a brand new story. So if you know them, you know, it's great, and if you don't. But the scholars, yeah, they can see the work, and they recognise the lines, because there's lots of quotes all the way through as well.
Yes.
But they just make me sound clever and funny, if you don't know that I didn't write that, so hurrah.
So it sounds like you're having an awful lot of fun with this show.
Yeah. I mean, I always have fun with my shows. Like, I'm a comedian. I'm always looking for laughs. I enjoy doing the shows, and I always have audience interaction in the shows, and that's what sort of keeps it fresh. I mean, different audiences react in different ways, and it never ceases to amaze me, the difference in an audience. Like, you know, I've had really practically dead audiences, and then just ones that are screaming with laughter and had 10 minutes of the length of the show. So it's the exact same material. It's always amazing to me. But it's got to be fun, otherwise what am I here for?
Exactly. Well, I'm going to ask a question that's going to get into trouble if you answer it. Where are the best audiences?
Oh, you know what? I honestly, I have had shit crowds and fabulous crowds in nearly everywhere that I've gone. The only place I reckon in the world so far I haven't had a shit crowd is Southland.
Fair enough.
I've always had, you know, like, they're hardy bunches down there. But, you know, like, I've done shows in Gore, Riverton, Invercargill, always Stewart Island, always had good crowds. But, you know, I've had both wonderful and terrible crowds practically everywhere. And I really don't think, because people ask me that all the time, and I really don't think there's much difference regionally to me. Like, I've just seen a vast gamut in all places.
Sounds reasonable. So I notice you seem to be working forward in time as your plays are coming on. So we started off in about the 18th century. We're now firmly into the 19th. I know you only just started touring Olive Copperbottom, but where are you going to go next?
Well, I think before all of this, I was doing sort of dirty cabaret shows. Like I did a show, Hot Pink Bits, which is about the history of the sex industry. So actually that didn't go all the way back to 30,000 years BC and then to the present with all various different saucinesses. And I kind of miss, I mean, I do really love these literary endeavours, but I kind of miss being a bit filthy and high heels and stuff like that. So I think the next thing I'm going to do is actually cabaret, where I play all the different characters behind the scenes of a cabaret, sort of like the Muppet Show, but no Muppets. Like I'd be the comedian and the magician, and you know, and all that sort of stuff is the fermenting idea as yet.
So we're sticking with the one woman show theme, are we?
Yes, we are. Yeah, it's just easier for rehearsal scheduling for touring as well, because I have done group shows with my improv company, and actually I have got a woman, Laurie, we keep meaning to talk about doing a two-hander for improv. She's almost as footloose and fancy free as me. She has no children, I have no children. She owns houses, I don't, of course, but I can sort of go away for extended periods without much issue, but there's not actually many people that can do that on the same sort of timing that I can. So that's why I like it. It's also cheaper. I'm very tight. I like to keep all of the money from myself. It's an expensive business and I never get any funding, so I'm always sort of streamlining the ways to make it the most cost effective.
Fair enough. Well, we wish you the best of luck with the rest of the tour. Hope it goes well. And thank you very much for finding the time to talk to us today.
Okay. Oh, that's a good chat, Steve. Hey, so if we want to see Penny Ashton, when's she starting this tour?
Well, she's on tour already. There are going to be dates up on the Crave Podcast website. And yep. I'll be catching her toward the end of the tour, unfortunately. But I'll be catching her in Onifero, just south of Tuakau, near Auckland. Yeah. Next month, and then she's coming up to Howick as well. So she's covering the entire country.
Yeah, fantastic. Now, this is the point where I usually throw to you, Steve, to say you to sum up what's coming up, but I'm going to start this time.
Yes.
Because I want to talk about an announcement. We just put it on the website a few days ago. Oh, that we haven't attempted to tell you what the website is. It's cravepodcast.com.
We should be plugging this at least every 2-3 minutes, shouldn't we? Simon,
yeah, we should.
Simon.
Cravepodcast.com. Hey, so there was an announcement of a tour coming up where the promoters would not tell us the name of the act, invited the media to come down to a setting in the central Auckland for a mystery announcement. So we went along, or I went along, and it turned out to be an announcement for the pretty famous British magician called Dynamo. That's not his real name, but he's known as Dynamo. You've probably seen him on TV. He does a lot of street magic, does a lot of big stunts where he walks across the River Thames or hangs off the side of buildings in midair. He's been around for a few years and become very, very popular, and he is coming here. So that was great. But it turned out that he actually came here to be part of the announcement of his tour. The tour's not till July, but he comes here in April for the announcement of the tour, which is a bit different.
Well, so who needs an excuse to come have a weekend in Auckland?
Yeah,
it's a great
place. Exactly. So he was there taking some questions from us, and then at the end of that, we were told to switch off all our recording equipment, and he did three magic tricks for us just in the room.
Oh, how brilliant.
Yes.
Now, if I'm not mistaken, he's very much close magic, isn't he?
What magic? Sorry,
close magic. The decks of cards and things like that. Yeah?
He's certainly that's a lot of what he does with the street magic is with small little groups of people, and he's standing right next to them. With you're right, that sort of very hands-on, excuse the pun, magic. And so he said he spent 2 years working out how he can somehow translate what is generally an intimate style of magic to an arena, because he's playing at the Horncastle Arena in Christchurch. The dates are on the website, but I think the Christchurch dates are the early 20th or 21st of July, somewhere around about there, and coming up to Spark Arena in Auckland about the 25th, 26th or so. So all he would say about it was that he is going to involve the audience, and whether you're at the front or at the back of the arena, you could still be involved. So he might pop up somewhere in the crowd at any stage. So that was a good way to tease something, isn't it? I think... they showed a promotional video. He's a very entertaining chap. He's from your part of the world, Steve. He's Bradford. That's not too far from where you hail from originally.
Well, it's Yorkshire, so he's foreign, obviously. He's Yorkshire.
He's foreign, but he's in the same latitude.
Wrong side of the Pennines, but other than that, we'll forgive him.
Okay.
And, 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 And you say Dynamo's not his real name. I love the way you felt the journalistic need to put that clarification in there.
Of course, there are lots of people I call Dynamo, as you know.
Oh, it's a common name in Yorkshire, yeah. Look, you know, every evening, about 6 o'clock, there's a whole load of mothers go out in the street and yell, Dynamo, come in for your tea. And there's about 17 or 18 lads turn around going, which one, ma'am?
Yeah, exactly. Well, geez, I mean, hey. Anyway, so...
Anyway, moving swiftly onwards.
That's right. Well, I think it's quite a common name all over the place. Anyway, just one other thing very quickly to mention about him is if you have seen him on TV, he's a very slim looking young fellow, but the man we met in person was a slightly heavier chap. And I the reason I'm mentioning this is because he talked about it himself straight away. He sadly has been battling a Crohn's disease for some time.
Oh, bugger.
I think it's quite a serious a disease which affects your intestines and your bowel, and he's had in it, you know, you have to battle away through medication. So he's insists that he's managing it okay and he can still put on a show. So when he does turn up, if you go along to see him, he's going to look a little different than you've seen him on TV. That's Stephen Frayne is his real name, by the way.
Are we sure it's the same person?
Good question. Yeah. I think so. Having met him, I think it's so. I think so.
Oh, you shameless name dropper, Mercep.
Well, I actually got up on this little stage with him and took part in a magic act with him.
Oh, you.
But I can't tell you what it was because I've been sworn to secrecy. Isn't that that's mind-numbingly, terribly frustrating for me? But I can't do it.
You were the Sorcerer's Apprentice.
Yes. Well, I'm your apprentice, so hey.
So
there you are. Look, he's a very accomplished magician. If magic is your thing, I'm sure you would enjoy him. And he's got a very sort of working class, down to earth sort of a persona about him. I guess coming from Bradford, you probably would.
Right.
And so, yep, I think he'll do. And the details of the dates are on our website. Any other dates we should be keeping an eye out for?
There's a couple of other things. I mean, possibly not quite in the same league as Dynamo. Shania Twain has announced a second Auckland date for her first ever New Zealand tour.
Yes.
We've mentioned that, we can move on now. the Auckland Comedy Festival is coming up soon. Quality control has to be a big issue when you get a festival as big as that. But we've picked out two or three acts that are particularly worth having a look at. So do go to the website, cravepodcast.com, to see what we reckon is looking like going to be the most interesting acts in that particular event. There's two concerts that are worth mentioning because there's a kind of a curious concept going on behind them. First one is a band with the wonderful title of The Disappointments.
It's a great name, isn't it?
It is. It's
can you imagine someone announcing, "Here are The Disappointments"? Just yeah. Kind of.
Well, I mean, how do you review them? Well, disappointing. Yeah. One name that I often see when I go and collect my tickets for reviews is the name Brent Eccles.
Right.
Who is one of the leading concert promoters in New Zealand. Mm-hmm. And he's formed a band with a couple of his own mates who are... I've lost the names here. Hammond Gamble and Andy McDonald.
Oh,
They're okay. Yeah. We've got some names with a bit of pedigree within the music industry. And they've basically put themselves a bit of a band together called The Disappointments. They got together to play together, and they needed a name, and that's what they called themselves. And they've recorded. And, you know, they apparently said, "Oh, do you remember back when you used to be able to go to concerts for a book ahead? Back when?" And so that's what they're doing.
Oh. Be interesting to see Hammond Gamble. I remember him in a band called Street Talk in New Zealand way back in the 80s, and I thought he was a veteran player back in the 80s. So. I don't mean that. I'm not being cruel to Hammond Gamble, but he'd been around for a while back then. He was a very accomplished musician.
Exactly. Well, that's what they're harking back to. Yeah, I mean, in the press release, it does say that, you know, for the mid-70s, Street Talk were part of the pub circuit.
Yeah, they were.
And so what they're going to do is they're going to be Tuning Fork for one night only, Fork in Auckland, next to the Spark Arena there, have a guess how much the tickets are.
No.
Yes.
A dollar?
A buck ahead.
Wow.
Seriously. In fact, I don't know, it's probably sold out by now.
I would have thought, yes.
But it will be worth going and taking a look. It's on April the 25th. Actually, you know, tickets not sold out yet because they're going to be available online from Friday, April the 20th.
So that's actually on Anzac Day, April the 25th, they're playing. That's interesting. Okay.
Yes. Yeah. So that would be an interesting one to get yourself along. So I could say it's worth a bit of a setup, that one, I think.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Similarly, Barking Mad is... yes. No, seriously, this one really does cross the line into profoundly peculiar. I don't suppose the name Stephen Adler will ring any bells.
Oh, it's sort of half a clapper.
Yeah, he was also in a fairly well-known 80s beat combo.
Yes.
He was the drummer for Guns N' Roses.
Oh, okay. Well, now, shame my ignorance here.
Well, he's coming to the Power Station in Auckland on Thursday, May the 24th. He's going to one-off show. He and his band are going to do the entire of Appetite for Destruction, Guns N' Roses' first album.
Right.
But his support act, and I'm not making this up, is his mum.
What?
Yes, you heard that correctly. His support act is Deanna Adler.
What will she do?
Well, she is, and I'm quoting from the press release here because, you know, I want to get this right. She's the author of Sweet Child of Mine, How I Lost My Son to Guns N' Roses. Because apparently she's been quite the historian of, in particular, her son's career.
Yeah.
Diaries, journals, personal letters, scrapbooks, photographs. And so she's going to be talking about a very, very personal, very intimate, behind-the-scenes account of her little boy, Stephen.
Wow.
Playing alongside Slash and Axl Rose. So even though, I mean, obviously, we set it up to sound a bit daft, it sounds fascinating.
Yeah, interesting. Okay. Oh, well, great.
I think that's going to be really, really cool.
Okay. Hey, now, before we go, you know, Steve, I just was thinking, just hearing you discuss that, we should just make the point to people listening to this podcast that, you know, Crave is an absolutely mega media empire, is it not? And apart from listening to us on the podcast and visiting our website, we follow us on Twitter, and you, Steve, put out links to sometimes video clips from the concerts we see in the live. We encourage our listeners to keep across all the outlets that we offer to keep up with our coverage.
Well, if you're not subscribing to our following to our Twitter feed, I mean, you have to ask yourself, what are you doing with your life? This is where you will find, as you quite rightly say, Simon, this is where our listeners will find links to YouTube videos. We've got a couple of videos from the Crow Etheridge concerts are up already. Right. Yeah. There's always updates on concerts and the like. We'll tweet links to our reviews. So yeah, follow us on Twitter and keep up with what we're up to. I mean,
yeah,
I put a lot of thought into our Twitter handle name, at Crave Podcast. Hours of thought. It was focus group, that name was.
yeah, very right, and rightly so.
Absolutely.
So let's just summarise all that. So if you want to email us,
and we'd love to hear you.
Yeah. The email is podcast@cravepodcast.com.
Now, as we said, we're on Twitter. We're also on Facebook. Either way, we're at Crave Podcast.
Right. So that you're covered there.
You've got no excuse.
No excuses, no. So in the meantime, nice. Thanks for listening. I'm Simon Mercer.
I'm Steve McCabe.
And that's what's been entertaining us this week.